somos un país bloqueado. Sí, yo pienso que por lo menos se ha visto trabajando positivamente en varios sectores.
Ahora creo que va en buen camino, ha querido con todas sus cosas poco a poco y ha querido mejorar el país. Ha querido sustituir exportaciones por las importaciones mismas de nosotros, ha querido realzar esto de poco a poco y ha sido un año bastante difícil, pero bueno, hasta ahora desde mi punto de vista como joven creo que va por buen camino.
Realmente lo considero exitoso, exitoso, porque ha seguido la línea del comandante y de la revolución como tal.
Para este analista cubano, el mandatario ha enfrentado un año complejo debido al difícil contexto económico doméstico y el adverso panorama internacional marcado por la agresividad de Washington contra la isla. No obstante, el jefe de Estado ha liderado el país con varios aciertos.
En el plano político, los cambios han sido muchos. Hay una nueva constitución, hay una apertura del espacio público con la apertura de internet, en los datos móviles, con la insistencia del presidente en utilizar los mecanismos electrónicos para la gobernanza. Es decir, tenemos el país ha continuado cambiando y esos cambios han ido en la dirección, aunque quizás no suficientemente, pero en la dirección que ha cambiado la sociedad cubana.
Incrementar la eficiencia económica ha sido su prioridad en medio de un escenario tenso en que los envíos de petróleo desde Caracas han disminuido sustancialmente y las exportaciones no han alcanzado sus ingresos proyectados.
Los problemas están básicamente en que no se ha logrado articular todo lo que implica la reforma económica, todo lo que implica la actualización del modelo económico cubano. Eso todavía está pendiente y no ha avanzado con la celeridad que debió avanzar.
Potenciar sectores claves como el turismo, la biotecnología, energías renovables, infraestructura y servicios médicos son las prioridades económicas del gobierno de Miguel Díaz-Canel en los próximos años. Raimundo Urrechaga, Hispan TV.
Aquí concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de RTN, de Telesur, de Radio de Naciones Unidas, del Informativo Farco, de Hispan TV y del diario La Jornada. A nombre de Norma Martínez se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
And coming up next on the Stream of Free Radio, it's Bathrobe Spears broadsides the June 27th, 2019 edition. Lots of updates, or a few anyway, and an interview with City Council member Drew Glover. Bits and pieces from the City Council meeting of last Tuesday and the Public Safety Committee meeting of the Monday before that, and whatever else I can piece together in 2 hours' time. So stay tuned.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
And it looks like kind of a busy week ahead. Tomorrow morning, there's going to be visiting the 1220 River Street Campground will be the California Union of the Homeless. Alicia Cool, president, will probably be there, along with Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs, checking out the campground out there and seeing if anybody wants to join up with the union. Some of the folks there have been displaced from the Ross camp, and they found some survival headquarters or survival space, kind of cramped space, but indeed at least space from free from police raids, although, of course, there is a kind of a restrictive series of regulations they do have to follow. Admittedly, I've got to say, less restrictive than the year before. Under Susie O'Hara's leadership, you now have Eric Snickars, who's been running the campground, and will be running it until March. There's a new head of the campground, I should say, above Eric Snickars, which is run by the Salvation Army. And that's a fellow I haven't met yet or talked to called Marcos Velasquez. I'm sorry, Vasquez, I believe it is. That's at least the name I got from Eric earlier today when we spoke by phone. So Alicia and Keith may be able to give us a report on how things went out there at the campground. It's still very limited access. You can't simply walk in and out, particularly even if you're a resident there. That's not not allowed by the rules. You have to enter in and out either by a bicycle, which they allow you to store there, one bike in the storage locker, or use the hourly shuttle, which generally runs during the daytime hours. If you're from the outside and you want to come in and visit, you can only do so in the approved visiting area. I guess you can also go to the porta potties, but you can't go into the private personal quarters of the people, even if they are inviting you in. And I didn't haven't interviewed Eric on the rationale for this, although I did challenge him. That seems pretty restrictive. If you're visiting someone at their residence or at their campground, for that matter, you're usually not prohibited from going into their tent. In this case, you are. The rationale he gave me when I talked to him a week or so ago was, he thought this is what the campers wanted because there'd be too many people walking around, and maybe it's what they would wish. And I said, well, have you consulted the campers? And he said, no. And I said, well, before you impose those kinds of restrictions on them, you might want to do that. He expressed a willingness to do that, but he hasn't, as far as I know, held any such meetings, although there has been some sort of, some talk about it. One of the campers there who attended a HUF meeting, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group I work with, which meets every Wednesday, we met yesterday, did show up, but he didn't. He said there's been some talk about organizing in the campground, and maybe that'll be happening tomorrow with this Union of the Homeless tabling that's happening. I may show up for it as well. If you want to get in and visit someone in the campground there, you have to get on their visitors list, which means you have to get them to put you on the list. And you also, the specific regulations talk about having to contact them a half an hour in advance before you come. But according to Eric, if I understand it right, and I'd like to get some reports from people who've actually experienced this, it takes they're looser about that than they might be. You also have the visiting hours are limited. I think it's 10 to 3 or some such thing. If you want to contact by phone, you really need to have someone inside who has a phone, and you can reach them and let them know you're coming. So there can be some kind of communication about that happening. I mean, it would seem you should be able to walk in and knock on the gate and say, hey, I'm on the list. I want to see so-and-so. It's during the visiting hours. Let me in. And maybe in practice that's how it happens. I have heard that in practice there's very little visiting that actually happens for whatever reason. Supposedly the visiting rules are posted. I don't know that they're posted online for the community yet, and I think Eric gave me leave to post them. Of course, he doesn't have to give me leave, but I haven't posted them on any of my websites. I don't really know that someone would come to the Huff website, or it should be, I think, on the city's website, but certainly, as far as I know, it hasn't been posted there. Also, this only impacts 61 people. And there's a very low turnover there. Although there's some difference of opinion, Eric says there's only, two or three or four vacancies a month. Maybe a few more, I'm not sure. And there's a long waiting list, 30 or 40 people. I'm vaguely remembering this, not giving you a very exact number. But it's not something you should count on getting into. Eric was talking about setting up a access point at the library where people could come in, apply, but it's kind of there may be an issue of social service agencies recommending. I think there's a pool of applicants. It's not sure access by any means, and there's not much space there. It's also, I've heard very hot in the tents during the day. At least that was the comment of Greg, who lives there. He was, again, visiting us yesterday at the Huff meeting. And it's not too clear what kind of provisions they're making for people under those circumstances. Of course, people did survive there last summer, because this was a campground for folks last summer. And one of the issues, of course, is that some people believe, dodging the police and the rangers outside. You do get, last year you got one meal a day, now you get two meals a day. But again, remember, there are 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people outside and only 61 inside this campground. And it's 75,000 to 90,000 a month that's paying for it, which is a huge amount of money considering that could be spent on other homeless folks. And so it's kind of a scandal, really, and it's kind of a scam. And also it is being done at the same time as allowing other campgrounds to happen. Is this something the city council is refusing to do so far, and the city authorities are refusing to do? Thus, the old Ross campground, of course, was forcibly dispersed, fenced off. Although I understand, I'm told the area is now no longer policed, so for those who want to go back there, it's not that they'll let you, but there's not as much policing. Though it's a pretty open area, pretty visible from the highway. It's hard to say what would happen if people did return there. But, of course, there are many people, not just those who left the Ross campground, but people who are without shelter throughout the city area, hundreds and hundreds of them, who find places to sleep where they can. Some of them have gathered in small campsites. One of them, I think, was at the end of Felker Street for a while. I'm not sure if it's still there. And it's been my suggestion that folks with the Conscience in Action and Huff groups, those are two groups concerned with civil rights and taking action to support civil rights, support new campsites and new campgrounds for people, because there's just no shelter for people in the city of any real amount. Now, that said, I did get the word from SNCCRs today that the Salvation Army as well as running the River Street Campground, is also running the 7th Avenue Shelter. Well, it has been, and that will be kept open through the end of August. And Laurel Street will also be kept open, and it will, beginning July 1st, start to take in people who are, well, all adults, not just women and children. So that, I don't know whether a shelter capacity is. I've heard said there are a number of spaces either at 7th Avenue or at Laurel Street, 7th Avenue particularly, because for some reason people aren't using 7th Avenue that much. I've heard as many as 20 spaces. I think either that number or a larger number was claimed by Susie O'Hara at the Public Safety Committee meeting, which was held on Monday, which I mentioned we are going to be following a little of. In fact, maybe I'll begin to get into that one so we can hear some thoughts on some of the issues that concern me. Public Safety Committee is a committee of the City Council which supposedly looks into issues of the Police Department and the Fire Department. And since it's the Police Department that has been going after homeless people for survival behaviors, confiscating their property, and using the Parks and Rec Rangers for enforcement activities increasingly in the last few years, it's important to see what kinds of activities they're engaged in. And so I'll play a little bit of that hearing now. Public Safety Committee, June 24th, Crown, Glover, and Myers here. In the audience,
sure.
Susie O'Hara is a staff person, Jessica Ewerk, and a couple of folks from the fire department, Serge, Lyon, me.
I'm not going to say just. I'm working on it. I'm working on it. Got to highlight the gray.
Okay, an exciting event as always. Want to welcome everyone. Just so everyone knows,
that's true, Glover.
This meeting is being audio recorded for the community to be able to observe later on, which is really wonderful.
He's the chair.
And we'll just jump right in. If we would please, Susie, call to a roll call.
Chair Glover?
Here.
Vice Chair Crown?
Here.
Meeting Member Myers? Here.
Excellent.
And that, of course, reading the roster is Susie O'Hara, who is the woman notorious for essentially helping to shut down the Ross camp while supposedly supporting the campers and providing endless reassurances that there is adequate shelter for the folks who were being dispersed, while in fact there was nothing of the kind, and making the same claims in court. Actually contradictory claims, along with other city officials, as part of their rush and determination to close the camp, regardless of the plight of the people in it.
So with that, we'll just move right into public comments. So this is for items not listed on the agenda. So if anyone would like to come up and speak to anything that's not on the agenda, we'd love to hear from you.
Chair, how long would you like to give for this?
I'll go 3 minutes, just since we have so few people.
Okay. So I would encourage this group to...
Just a second.
Hold on a second. I'm sorry.
I got
to put 3 minutes on.
No problem. Thank you. And is there anyone else in the audience that is interested in speaking on items not on the agenda tonight? Okay. Thank you. Take it away, Mr. Norris.
Thank you. So the Public Safety Committee is kind of a de facto substitute for what once was the Citizens Police Review Board. A very ineffective substitute, ineffective as the Police Review Board was when we had it. But at least it tried to focus, particularly in its latter days, on what was going on in the police department in terms of concerns that some of us had in the community, as well as policy matters that were being, well, ignored by the police department or needed to be researched and were not getting the attention of the City Council. So you have really the responsibility that's the public, the police review board once had. And because you have this, I'm reminded of what they did in the Police Review Board in terms of public comment. Oral communication was much more open, didn't involve a 3-minute limit. It involved essentially allowing people to talk for a reasonable amount of time to finish what they had to say. People were encouraged to kind of wind it up after a while. It rarely went on for more than 4 or 5 minutes. And a lot of people didn't show up. And that may be the case with the Public Safety Committee as well. So I would encourage you to adopt a different style than the very tight and I think somewhat abusive procedure that's being done by City Council, because this is an area where the public really has sort of maximum input. City Council is kind of a much higher level. City Council is eager to finish its business. Here you have a chance to have more interaction with the community. They have a chance to present themselves to you. I so often hear from City Council, oh, leave us your papers, we'll look at them later. You know, and I'm not saying the City Council does not. But the issue really is it's not just speaking to the City Council, it is speaking to the community, and it is making a record for the future as to what is important to members in the community, regardless of what the City Council says or thinks or subsequently does. So I would encourage you to take that under advisement and to essentially, as chair, make a decision that says oral communication will be conducted differently here than at the City Council meetings. I'm not entirely clear on substance matter. I don't want to talk about issues that are on the agenda. I understand you're having a community input on public safety opportunities, and I think I'll reserve some of my comments, which are about that kind of, it's a broad category. But until then, thank you.
And my point, of course, was that since Drew Glover is the chair of this committee, and you see Mayor Watkins making all kinds of executive decisions as chair of the City Council, he can do something similar if he wants, and actually, but in the opposite direction, extend public comment, allow questions from the audience, engage in dialogue with members of the audience and allow them to raise their hands and respond to staff presentations. These are all things that he could do. Which only one or two of which, or maybe one of which, I mentioned at this introductory speech at the oral communications section of the Public Safety Committee. They don't meet very frequently. I think they meet either quarterly or bimonthly, although I guess the chair may have the option to, probably does have the option, to call meetings more frequently. So there's that. Here's more. So the first item on the agenda was the fire department. There was a long report on fire department issues, which lasted about half an hour, actually. And then the chair, Glover, turned to Susie O'Hara for assistance as to does he allow public comment. Of course, he's his first time as chair. He doesn't know. But again, The bad practice, I think it is a bad practice, of relying on the staff to give answers to really important procedural questions. She said there was, and that's true, there is public comment. In fact, if she said there wasn't, I would have probably jumped up and growled at something. But it's not wise, and I'm particularly, of course, concerned with O'Hara's role in creating a false narrative about shelter, not just for the Ross camp, but just throughout the last couple of years, where she presents the sunny face of the city's attempt to claim to the public that all is well with the homeless, that things are just going along fine, that they don't have to pay any attention to ongoing police abuses, that these are the fault of the homeless people or under control by the police department. There's adequate shelter for anyone who wants it. These are false statements that are actually the familiar territory for a lot of cities and certainly for Santa Cruz. But she's been a person that backs these statements, or at least the statements about false shelter, with regularity and a flood of rhetoric. And so much so that I've even called her the eighth city council member on city council. Anyway, here's the public comment that I gave in response to the fire chief's. That was Mr. Hayduk's, his commentary, which was not about homeless stuff at all, but I chose to speak about something that he presented in the court case of the Ross Camp dispersal, where he was a key witness in the city's claim that it should be able to send 200 people to nowhere all the same, at the same time claiming they were sending them to somewhere.
Love to hear from the public, so if anyone would like to come up and talk with us about fire safety for 2 minutes.
Or safety from the fire department. I'm concerned about the politicization of the fire department, which I saw in federal court a month and a half, 2 months ago, when Mr. Hayduk, who's a good guy, I like him, we've had conversations before, he's been candid. However, when people are supporting the city's position, which in this case had to do with running homeless people out of the Ross camp, after a deafening silence of 4 or 5 months, the fire department suddenly decides there are massive fire dangers at the Ross camp, and so helps to disperse them into even more dangerous situations, not specifically with respect necessarily to fires, though I would say without a community present, there's less chance of a fire being contained than there was, let's say, at the Ross camp, where there were several fires. There's also a concern I have regarding these staff presentations. This is one, it's taken up 40 minutes of the time. I'm not saying that that isn't necessary, and it may well give us important information. A lot of it had to do with simply reading accounts that might have been on this agenda. I just talked to Susie here, who said that often what she does is have these presentations on slides presented later, but that doesn't help the community that wants to be involved in the situation. And I myself haven't got a lot to say about this particular report, because of course I had no opportunity to read it beforehand or to comment on it, and it's kind of hard to amass all that and respond, as you probably notice as you watch it and perhaps nod out as you do. I would encourage you to not so much necessarily limit the time of staff presentations as let them know you've gone on 5 minutes, you've gone on 10 minutes. You want to encourage them to be more concise, to summarize, and to show in their way more respect for the public, who is suddenly reduced to 2 or 3 minutes. And how many minutes did I have for this presentation?
That was two.
How about three? Because I think at least, are there any other speakers here?
Would anyone else like to address us on the issue of fire? No? Would everyone okay with spending an extra minute? Okay, absolutely. Go ahead.
Thanks.
And so indeed, Glover did extend, gave me an extra minute there. But the whole process of having to kind of wedge your way forward to make additional comments is, it shouldn't be necessary. It's a kind of a burdensome thing that if you were having real open communication on these issues, it wouldn't be happening this way. But instead, of course, you have the staff of the city has endless amounts of time, and the rest of us are simply shoeboxed into these small amounts of time. Even in situations where we're talking to people who would prefer that we had more time, because they're reluctant to exercise their powers here. And we're going to actually learn a little bit more about that when we hear Drew Glover's interview with me, although that subject did not come up specifically. You can hear generally that Glover is under recall threat. He was under investigation for, I don't know what, sexist or harassment. Can't get a straight answer out of him as to what the nature of the investigation was, even though it's over. It's a kind of a dark shadow of intimidation that city officials, in a way, they volunteer for this kind of restriction. And the problem is, in so doing, the community that they supposedly represent also falls under these restrictions. And the voice that they hope, the community hopes, that these individuals will give them from a platform of power is muffled or quieted or timidified. But here's the next minute.
I mean, one thing I noticed, I looked at the map, there are 45 dots of fires for this since January this year, according to what I read. Yet we also hear that there are 21 fires since the beginning of this year. Obviously, maybe I'm misunderstanding, it's not clear, but we don't have the information beforehand to take a look at. Why do I talk about the politicization?
So, in other words, what's going on here is the slideshow that was being shown to the public and to the Public Safety Committee is not available as a printout for the public to read beforehand, and the documents that are available in their agenda packet do not cover the slideshow. Now, O'Hara told me when I asked for a copy of those documents that they would make them available afterward. But, of course, what I've done at City Council is somewhat more militant. I said I've essentially interrupted the council meeting and said, make those documents available to us now so that we can know what's going on. Otherwise, don't discuss them on the agenda. Don't present them to the City Council this way. It's not appropriate to do this and to the public if you're not allowing the members who are present from the community who've come to speak on the issue to actually be able to know what we're talking about and to follow them along as we go and to actually have read them, to have access to them. It's just required, actually, by state law, and they aren't doing that. Perhaps they're going to tell us, well, slideshows aren't required by state law. You know, we can give you a copy of them later. If the slideshows are also being presented in paper form to the members of the council or to the Public Safety Committee, they are required. So that was what this was about. A lot of my objections at these meetings have to do with procedure because it can be very important, not necessarily in this particular case, but at other times that one have this information. And if the city makes it a practice of playing loose and fast with the not allowing the public or not bothering to make available this kind of stuff to the public, then the public doesn't know what's going on when even more important matters come up. Of course, I don't think the city council and often many of their subcommittees or advisory commissions care particularly what the public thinks. I think that their interest is in simply kind of getting through the meeting, addressing the issues that the staff presents to them, following what their appointing city council members tells them they want done. In other words, I believe that the actual force of any real public involvement is very, very limited and is generally ignored, particularly by the higher city council itself.
Because I think at least, are there any other speakers here?
Would anyone else like to address us on the issue of fire? No? Is everyone okay with spending an extra minute?
No.
Okay, absolutely.
And what we have here is I'm going back a little bit to put a little bit more of this additional minute, this conversation I had with them regarding the essentially politicization of the police department under Heideck, who is not necessarily unusual in this regard, who's not necessarily terribly bad, but is an example of it.
Penalty of perjury in federal court around issues such as the question about inspections and how dangerous it was, how much help the city was supposed to provide to campers out there, and there were statements that some of us regarded as false, not necessarily maliciously false, not necessarily intentionally false, but it's dangerous when the fire department becomes part of the process of the city's what I believe is a misguided policy of simply driving away visible homeless people from the only encampment we've had. That's what I got to say.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Consider changing the staff situation in terms of time.
Thank you. And does it look like we have another person who would like to speak?
Yes.
Wonderful. Come on out and go through this.
Just a point of reference.
So Lieutenant Martinez then, I think it's Lieutenant or Deputy Chief, my apologies to Martinez for the wrong office title, if I got it wrong, came up to discuss police stats, which were a little difficult to follow. They apparently had some problem with the presentation. One of their categories was wrong, and they had to correct it. But the main point has to do with, this is the issue that some of us have been raising, that while camping citations have gone down, almost, they claim zero, I don't think that's accurate, but it certainly has gone way down. Trespassing citations, including, and this is the significant point, making no distinction between public and private property, but on public property as well, and being in a park after dark or in a closed area after dark, have gone way up, or at least they did last year. Now, in the last half year, it appears they continue to be up, although there are half as many, of course, as there were last year, but then we're only halfway through the year. This is to say that people are supposedly not being harassed for the crime of sleeping as an act, but if they fall asleep on places that are the most obvious public places to sleep, a park, in the greenbelt, on the beach, maybe even on the sidewalk, they can, or in, you know, let's say in front of City Hall, where people, many people over the years have slept, and near any of the public buildings, these are because of suddenly created, administratively created closed regulations, where closed doesn't just mean the building itself, but it means the entire area around the building, as is the case of City Hall and the library and the police station. I don't know about the police station. Police station's closed the building. I don't know if the area around it is closed. But the area around the city is closed, City Hall, and the city buildings are closed between, I guess, from 6 o'clock on until 7 o'clock in the morning. I believe those are the hours, unless you happen to have a nighttime meeting, in which case it's half an hour after that meeting is closed down. So they will instead issue citations for those so-called crimes, if you're found there. I mean, even if you're not even sleeping, but sitting there with a sign that says, I'm here in a vigil all night to protest the city's abusive behavior on this or that issue. You would think that if it's the center of government, that would not be an issue. But it is. And it's also a crime to do that in front of the county building now. That was in response to the Occupy movement's all-night occupation there. But for homeless folks, it has become, supposedly, there's been a level of protection increased by the federal court's Martin versus Boise decision from Idaho, which found that laws criminalizing camping and, I'm trying to find the proper words, and there was an additional crime which had to do with resting, maybe it's lodging, I'm not sure, at night, or even during the day, you can't really give someone a citation for that unless you can give them a legal place to go that's on public property. And almost all cities do not have such places. They don't allow that. But they want to claim they do. And that, of course, is what the city did in the Ross Camp closing and does throughout with its various token shelter opportunities, as perhaps they would call them. So the point was to for us to show that get the police department to explain to this committee where they're telling people to go when they come along and want to move them along. Because not only do they use citations, which produce a paper record of the kind of harassment that homeless people are engaged in and force people to go to court to deal with fines or suffer real disabilities in their driver's licenses and elsewhere, because they don't pay those fines and get additional fines leveled on them. But they can simply threaten these kinds of citations and so force people to keep moving, picking up their stuff throughout the night, avoiding well-lit places if they're women or vulnerable elders who want to avoid harassment and think that by being in a well-lit place, they're more likely to, this may be a naive notion, get some kind of police protection or be less likely to be beaten quietly in the bushes with no one noticing. Of course, the opposite may also be true. Maybe feel that they're more targets in public. But if a group of people want to sleep together in a well-lit place, this could be a way of mutual self-protection and also discouraging vigilantes because they are maybe letting them know that they're defending themselves, that they feel they have the option to call the police, they have the option to video what's going on, and so forth. In any case, if if they can use the threat of a trespass citation to move people away, to just disperse groups of people, and that really is the issue as it was at Ross Camp, to disperse people away. There they used a health and safety concern, of course. That's another issue we've talked about in the past and we'll talk about again. But that has exactly the same force as a citation. It acts in exactly the same way to deprive people of their rights and their safety. So here's a little of that conversation. Chris Krohn, I believe, asked a question about it, although he didn't follow up, unfortunately, as council members often fail to do. And here's what we got.
A couple questions about the statistics. Noticing that there was zero campaign citations for January and May, but there were 360 park after hours violations. How did that rise so significantly from the year before? What do you attribute that to?
That's the correction that was made. We only had six for that year. That was a reporting error.
Okay.
Yeah, we saw that too, and we're like, whoa. So, yeah.
The other one is...
And I find it interesting, if true, and I don't think it is true, actually, in terms of the citations we counted in parks after hours, there were massive numbers of citations in the summer of last year. So I don't know how they got such a... Of course, I guess we're talking maybe, if they're talking about this year, maybe there was suddenly a huge drop. I would be surprised if this were so... Or alternately, I would be surprised if the police were actually telling people, you can be here, but instead saying something like, move along or I'll give you a citation, and then instead of just citing them immediately. And again, here I'm speculating, so I can't say, but I would encourage people who are listening to this who have knowledge of how police are treating people in parks and the Greenbelt after hours, whether they are leaving people alone or directing them to move, even though they're giving them no place to move to, under apparent threat of citation.
How does it feel when life doesn't seem real and you're floating about on your own? Your life is uncertain, so you draw the curtain, pretending there's nobody home. But don't theorize, look in your eyes, they can't tell lies, though you disguise what you see. The mirror is free. We once had a savior, but by our behavior, the one that was worth it is gone. Songbirds are talking and the runners are walking. A prodigal son is coming home. Don't theorize, look in his eyes. They won't tell lies, but if he defies what you see, he'll give you the key. So built a computer and we programmed ourselves not to see the truth and the lying, the dead and the dying, a silent majority. But don't theorize, look in their eyes, are they telling lies, the ones that they learn on TV? What a way to be free.
And it's back to the Public Safety Committee meeting. Here's me in response to the police department's claim that there is no rise in, actually a serious drop in tickets in closed areas at the same time as there's drop in camping. And again, however, there's been no real investigation whether people are essentially still being driven out of areas where they're trying to rest and they have no other options to be. Let's see what, let's hear.
How many people, just for an idea? Okay, two?
Two?
No. All right. 3 minutes. Take it away.
I noticed that the no trespassing rise does not mention whether it's public or private property. And this is very significant because as a member of HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, I get reports about ticketing. In fact, I got the report of the 12 tickets that you were asking about. I saw the 12 tickets. They were, as the lieutenant pointed out, having to do with parking violations, but they were done in the interesting fashion. The 12 tickets suddenly appeared within a 72-hour period after 2 years of no action around that issue in the Harvey West area.
And this refers to something that regular listeners may remember was on a prior show. A woman named Jenai had presented me with 12 parking citations she got in her oversized vehicle, or her RV, I guess it was. I think she was in an RV, or maybe it was in her car, or maybe it was one or both, all within the period of 72 hours. And you might say, well, it's a different agency, it's not camping, and therefore this was kind of dismissed very quickly by the Public Safety Committee, who suggested, well, it's a different department. The issue, though, is whether there is any collusion or a general direction on going after people who are, in fact, engaging in life-sustaining behaviors, sleeping in a vehicle, using other ordinances, and using essentially the same centralized repressive apparatus, the state apparatus, although a different department, to go after them. And there's, I'm not sure who oversees the parking department. Maybe it's Public Works, probably is. Maybe it's Parks and Rec, I'm not sure. But in any case, it's certainly worth the attention of City Council members, and it certainly is as much an abuse as the use of the police department. So this is me, what you're hearing me talk about to the Public Safety Committee is this issue in terms of its being equally toxic, whether it's being done by the police department or by the parking authority. And indeed, parking enforcement is in at least one section of the city headed by Joe Habe, who's getting medals from the police department. Andy Mills gave him a medal at the same time as he was denounced by Alicia Cool and others at a press conference for harassing homeless people, even within the 72-hour period allowed for a vehicle to park in a public place on the street if they're legal. And in essence, what's happening is he was either responding to or initiating independently himself attacks on RVs parked in public neighborhoods because of his, what some presume are a prejudice he has against people who are living in their vehicles on the streets, presumably because they have no other place to be, and simply punishing them for it and harassing them for it. And this is a department of the police department that is involved in this, and so it's part of the same nasty general program, but it was sort of skimmed and skipped over by the Public Safety Committee.
So it seemed that certain officers are suddenly getting very diligent, depending upon complaints of neighbors, which you might say, well, that's appropriate. The question, though, is has to do with things like the 72-hour law, which has to do with not with being able to only park for a certain amount of time, but not being penalized for parking less than that time, even if a neighbor doesn't like the look of your vehicle. So we don't know. We know the camping citations have dropped, but we do not know because the information that you, Councilmember Glover, requested back in January still has not reached us, in spite of the fact that it was supposed to be available in May, then the second meeting in May, and then the first meeting in June, and then the second meeting in June tomorrow, and then it won't even really be on the agenda until August. This impacts homeless people outside significantly, and also the community's knowledge of this situation. I also understand this is being discussed in closed session tomorrow without its even being on the agenda as an explicit item. To me, this is a slap in the face of both the council members who proposed this, who tried to get this on the agenda but failed to do so, or one would have thought it was on the agenda. It was voted by a 4-3 majority to come on the agenda in early May. It's not there. So I'm concerned about that. So I would suggest and I would ask that this council say that this matter should not be discussed in closed session, should be in open session, and bring it out into open session. But moreover, that all this data, it was requested back in January, which City Attorney Condotti has already said he said that 2 months ago, be revealed to us so we can see what it is.
And in fact, the significance of discussing something in closed session, which is only supposed to be done with litigation matters, stuff that's under court action or is likely to be under court action, or personnel matters. And these statistics are about a policy. And the staff reports on it are about a policy, an analysis about whether homeless people are being unfairly or differentially or just unduly affected by some of these laws. That's what this was supposed to indicate and discuss. And that is no basis for being in closed session unless you want to keep it from the public and the community. Perhaps because some people would be ashamed of it or others would be angry about it. And when you make it in closed session, suddenly if you ask a council member about it, he will say, oh, no, I can't talk about it. It happened in closed session. Even though the original motion was an open session and the original demand by the city over the repressive, we're going to keep this off the agenda action by Mayor Watkins, was to put it on the May agenda, and it was supposed to be on the May agenda. And when it showed up there, we got the wah, wah, wah from City Attorney Condotti. I'm really sorry about this, but we didn't, you know, it's not there. We'll have it there next time. And, of course, it hasn't been there time after time. But it's been, if you ask even members privately about it, as you'll hear me asking Council Member Glover, say, I can't talk about it. It's on the closed session. And to show you the kind of power this kind of phony seclusion and segregation and shutting off of information has by people in power, suddenly want you to respect these bizarre rules that actually penalize the public and keep information from them. I myself feel intimidated when that kind of stuff comes up. I don't say, wait a minute, bullshit, Drew. That's nonsense. This is on the open agenda. I'm asking you a direct question. What's going on with this data? Why isn't it being revealed? What is being discussed in closed session that actually belongs in open session, in which you've got to have the courage to bring into open session, or at least to talk about members openly with, not to play this game of operating under the shadow of fear? And I'm intimidated from making that kind of response. And you'll hear me kind of back off in this next lengthy interview, which has kind of come down the pike after we finish listening to the Public Safety Committee material. That is, of course, after we take another musical break.
Tell me what in the hell we're paying taxes for? Well, what are we all? ladies and gentlemen, children of America, it's up to you. Let Mr. Politician know how you feel. Let him know that you're not going to take no more. Stop paying taxes. Stop paying for corruption and injustice. It's up to you.
And that was Sharon Jones and the Gap Kings, What If We All Stop Paying Taxes, 2002 song.
So I'm concerned about that. So I would suggest and I would ask that this council say that this matter should not be discussed in closed session, should be in open session, and bring it out into open session. But moreover, that all this data, it was requested back in January, which City Attorney Condotti has already said he said that 2 months ago, be revealed to us so we can see what it is. It's only fair to do this unless the department, for some reason, I wouldn't know why, is hiding something here. These stats, for example, mention, as I say, trespassing, but they don't clarify whether it's for what. I would also suggest tomorrow's performance evaluations for the city manager and the city attorney in closed session. This needs to be public. Some of us feel these people need to be replaced, and we need an opportunity to express these issues in open city council meetings, and not just at oral communications, but as an actual item in terms of considering how these folks have been doing. And I have more, but I take it you won't let me conclude.
Thank you. You've got to keep it even across the board. So I'm going to give Mr. Bruder 3 minutes.
I would say, and even make it as long as people need, up to 5 minutes.
Thank you. And that's something that we can think about for the next meeting, is whether 2.5 hours or 2 hours is enough time, or whether we need to extend the meeting for a longer period of time. Just before you start, Mr. Bruder, a couple of comments.
Mr. Norse and everyone else, you can make a presentation to the City Council before the City Council goes into closed session, too. So that's another avenue of
2 minutes.
Having an input.
2 minutes.
Thank you.
I get really annoyed when anybody presents the current procedures, which are completely inadequate for, let's say, a performance evaluation of the city manager or the city attorney. It's a very serious, complex, and a profoundly important position and requires extensive discussion. If you're allowed only a sound bite of 2 minutes, you're not going to be able to have a real discussion of this. There's not going to be a real analysis of what the problems have been with Martine Bernal and Tony Condotti, the two officials who were talking about the most highly paid officials in the city. Chris Krohn knows about this. And for him to say, you can talk about it for 2 minutes, if you come at 10:30 in the morning before in the open interval before the closed session, and we ignore you and go zip into the city council at the closed session, is, I have to imagine he's either being, he's sort of sneering at you, or he's doing the Martine Watkins, the Mayor Watkins process of saying, we don't mind, we're only going to give you a minute to talk at oral communication, but you can always hand us a bunch of papers which we'll read later. So the community doesn't get to hear this discussion. The city council is not confronted with the issues in a public and an open forum. But it could have been that Krohn was simply saying, we really would like you to talk about this issue. We don't like the city attorney and the city manager's general approach on these things. We'd love to see more public discussion. Do so, if you can, within the very constricted confines of the existing system. And that's the very charitable way of looking at what Krohn has said. And I don't want to misrepresent him or misinterpret him. So I don't know.
Sir, 3 minutes.
Hi.
Hello.
And away we go. This is basically speaking to the officers that were here giving the report. With the neighborhood policing team, when it was incepted...
And this is a discussion by a member of the public of how the East Side is not getting the communication with the police department that it needs around neighborhood policing, which certainly is an issue for folks, housed folks, and maybe some homeless folks. Well, it's hard to imagine that the police pay a lot of attention to homeless folks, though it has happened, usually in a negative way, but nonetheless. Anyway, so it's not, however, a subject that I have a lot of expertise in or terribly a lot of interest in, and that I think deserves a lot of attention on this show, because this is something that one would assume, if the police department doesn't pay attention to it, hopefully neighborhood groups and organizations do. Then there was a section on the public safety committee agenda, which Drew Glover opened up, which had to do with just general community input on how the CPRB should proceed. I mean, I'm sorry, how the Police Review Commission, Public Safety Committee, got to get these names right, should proceed. One person commended First Alarm's support for the police department, and then I spoke about issues which regular listeners are familiar with. And here's a little of that.
Okay. Again, I'm speaking based upon some work I've been doing with Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, a group that I work with and that meets on Wednesday. You guys are, and any member of the public is welcome to come. You meet at the Sub Rosa at 11 o'clock every Wednesday. And that's also the meaning of time of conscience and action. One thing that I've been concerned about as a community member, because I've been getting reports on this, is the use of how our police are doing when there is an issue of an individual that the...
miles an hour down the road.
Excuse me. That the police, for one reason or another, want to move along. So, for instance, we've gotten many reports, numerous reports, because I do this, I'm leaving here to go to the Red Church. Probably not in time to catch many people, but there's a meal there every Monday night, and people report in, and I then broadcast their comments on the radio about positive and negative experiences with merchants, police, residents themselves, and things of that sort. Frequently, what I've been hearing, and there is a concern by police, is there is, you'll have to leave here, you can't be here in this park after dark. You can't be in front of this building, sleeping here at night. And, of course, often the person will say, well, where can I go? And the police officer will say, that's not my problem. You just have to go. Now, this to me seems like it's a violation of the Boise versus Martin decision, because our city council, in its wisdom, though it's dispersed the Ross camp, has not provided in any way adequate facilities for those who are outside. Now, that means that there are 1,000 to 2,000 people outside who face this kind of cattle herding around the town at the whim or perhaps reluctantly by police officers under pressure from merchants or because they feel it's their responsibility. But they are doing this in violation of the Constitution. Now, we know that the city council, even the new majority, is not always the most fastidious about respecting the Constitution regarding the rights of poor people. We saw that a federal court had to be called in to hold them back for a week before they cooked up a plan to pretend to provide shelter for people. They provided shelter for 61 people at a camp and for limited amounts of people at 7th Avenue and out, you know, around the Capitola area, right on the edge of town. But the fact of the matter is most people are outside who are homeless. And they are being harassed, some of them. And if there is a problem, the police's responsibility is to leave them alone or to give them a decent place to go to. If they can't do that, then they are violating the law. And this council is looking the other way. Now, I would encourage this council not to do that. And, you know, what kind of solutions do I have? Well, first of all, you might inquire of the police department, what instructions are they giving to police officers who find someone resting at night in a place they don't want them to rest? Are they just leaving them alone? Or are they telling them to move on? And if they're telling them to move on what basis are they doing this?
And if they are telling to move on, are they giving them a place to go? Perhaps you can inquire of the police officials here who are available to answer that question, because a lot of us would like to know. When I spoke about holding the city manager and the city attorney responsible in a public session just to be evaluated so that you can hear from the community, and it really is kind of a joke what Councilmember Krohn is making when he says, oh, well, you can talk at the open interval for 2 minutes before we go into closed session. That is hardly time for the public to be able to speak to such a complex and powerful issue. These are the most powerful officials and the most highly paid officials in the city. The same goes for the police chief and the head of the Parks and Rec Department. I'm concerned about them particularly because in regard to this issue of Boise versus Martin, they rule the roost. They can instruct their officers not to bother these people. Now, this will cause outcry from those in the neighborhoods who want to have a tool, it's always a great word the police department use, for moving along people they consider undesirable. More important is the survival needs of the people outside. People inside have homes, heating, showers, all the things that you and I and everyone in this room pretty much take for granted. They don't. And I'm not speaking for them. I'm just speaking as a housed resident. I don't pretend to represent anybody who's outside. But that seems to me to be a civilized question that this police department has to honestly face and answer, and that you need to confront that department with, and hopefully in this meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Norris. So we are on item number 4, community input on public safety opportunities and challenges. So this is the time for the community to let us know of any opportunities or challenges that you would like for the public safety committee to work on or pay attention to outside of the things that are already on the agenda. This will help inform our work plan and things that we're focusing on over the next 3 to 6 months. So, if there's no one else from the community, I see two more.
Okay.
Okay.
And what's happening here is Councilmember Glover is quickly moving on to the next item. Instead of asking the police chief, or in this case it would be the, I guess it's the deputy police chief, or Martinez, who I'm assuming is a deputy police chief. I'm never quite sure. What do you do when you run across someone you want to move along? Do you give them a place to go? What's the story? And he instead moved on to the next item. But somebody else apparently wanted to talk, so instead we have that. And in essence, there is actually a dialogue. It turns out to be a dialogue between Martinez and the Public Safety Committee members on this issue.
Okay, so just because we have to go over our work plan and everything, so we'll give you 3 minutes for both of y'all, and then we'll take it away.
Forgive me, I just showed up. I don't know what you've discussed, and I haven't read the agenda.
Actually, Brent Adams
was talking about work plan. Warming Center program has anonymously, if that's possible, produced Connecting the Dots, the Homeless Needs Survey. The way reason I say anonymously is because we use an exclusively student intern survey crew. They went out. The only thing that identifies Warming Center is this, the reworking of our logo here, but the person being surveyed didn't see the logo at all. Anyway, 30 questions, 68 respondents. It's our second year in a row. And pertains to this body is one question number 5, and I'll give you copies of this. Do you feel safe when you sleep? Many questions ask, where do you go to the bathroom? Where do you get water? Citations that you may have received in the last 12 months. But this one in particular, and glaringly over, it's not a surprise to people who sleep outside feel safe when they sleep. A huge percentage said they feel that they're in a dangerous situation. We didn't ask why. And then the next grouping, not safe. And the next grouping, somewhat safe. That's, I would say, 75%, near 80% saying unsafe circumstances. And so I think we hear a lot of, we assume that people feel unsafe when they sleep outside. Does the house population feeling safe? But here's an actual data set. It's not, at the university level, it's not academic. It's really just us, students going out in the community, asking 68 people, 30 questions, in a very respectful moment.
And this, of course, is Brent Adams, who runs the day and night storage, and during the winter, the warming center, and who's been concerned about sanctuary villages, and is himself formerly, and perhaps every now and then, a performer on the streets, a drummer, and a community activist concerned with the rights of folks outside and counterculture people. Also a man who's had some severe disagreements with me. Last time we spoke on the air, you may remember, he hung up on me and told me I should never call him again. And I did try to call him today. But for one reason or another, he didn't answer. So perhaps he's still upset with me. It's interesting that he notes that his survey connecting the dots, which I hope to see online, and perhaps it already is online. You can find some of this stuff on the Facebook page, Day and Night Storage, out Santa Cruz, Homeless Outside in Santa Cruz, I believe it is. I may have that slightly wrong. And I did get a copy of it at his appearance at the Public Safety Committee, which I haven't read yet. My apologies, Brent. I should, and I hopefully will. But I notice he says 80% of the people outside that he surveyed report feeling unsafe. I just want to mention, maybe to twit Brent in his absence, that he is an advocate of ending the Ross camp in the hope that they would clear the area and set up the kind of campground that he feels would be better controlled, better contained, drug-free, properly receptive to community concerns, and so accepted by the community, which is so far, at least the more vocal reactionary elements of the community, rejected the campground, and by, most important, funding authorities, whether they're nonprofits or city government and county and state agencies. And I've always been worried about pandering to those groups, because I think they are very more concerned with treating homeless people like units that need to be stored or shoved aside or pushed out of sight or driven out of town or reduced into certain categories where they can be managed in ways that essentially dehumanize them, either as mental health problems or alcoholics or drug addicts or bums who are service resistant, whatever. So what Brent's concern about the Ross camp, where he which is right across the river from him in his work with a day and night shelter on Felker Street, he was very concerned with drug use there, and he felt it was a dangerous place for people and it had to be eliminated, and that people would be safer outside the Ross camp. Well, it seems like he's either changed his position, although you might say, well, he's talking about a broader number of people than simply the 300 people, 200 to 300 people who are in the Ross camp. His survey is a small sample, but it's a sample of the broader population of 1 to 2,000 homeless people in Santa Cruz City. But they don't feel safe. And the one question he didn't ask them, and I doubt was in the survey, is did you feel safer in the Ross camp? I'd be curious if he did, and I'd be surprised if he did. Because one of the problems is that Brent gets very passionately involved with his own system of management, his own solution. He's dedicated hundreds of hours more, probably thousands of hours of time to it, and energy, and much of his life recently. And so he has a heavy commitment in it, and people who challenge it incur his wrath. That's one of the problems he's had with, and differences he's had with Alicia Kuhl, who hopefully he will be working with, or at least parallel to in some way, in the months ahead, that we all need to be working in a way with somehow, in conjunction with each other, at least not at each other's throats. But it seemed clear to me then and now. And this is the reason that Brent kind of, I think, broke off communication with me in our last conversation, was I said, it seems ridiculous to claim, you know, you to deny the fact that you are in fact claiming that you didn't essentially advocate destruction of the Ross camp with no alternatives, because there are no alternatives. I mean, you might say you have some better alternatives proposed, but they're not available, and they're not about to be made available. So at the current time, you're suggesting their dispersal of that camp is a good thing. And that's, of course, an issue that we had a profound difference of opinion on. Back to Brent's presentation at the Public Safety Committee.
A lot of conversation happening, but we do have 64 respondents answering that question. So I think something it's really, you know, you don't have a data set like that to draw from in any other way. So I just want you to know about that. I don't have to speak to the thing about opportunities, but I will use the next few seconds to say that the Storage Warming Center operates the storage program, as you know, which reduces what people have to carry around. Over almost 500 people now. 478 people have used our program to date, discrete individuals. We have over 200, 250 people on our shelves right now. Huge cost savings to the city. Translates to a huge amount of safety for people. They're no longer identified as people who sleep outside. Many are walking around without carrying anything at all. Additionally, we're starting Laundry Wednesdays. Again, just securing funding right now, but one of the needs, clearly people are washing their garments in the river water. They're wearing them till they fall off. Very few people are accessing laundry, so I think that's also an important thing you want to look at. Please look it over, Connecting the Dots, student UCSC intern survey. Thank you.
I don't need much time. Can I give you my time?
And what's happening is Lyon, who's an activist who's in the audience, is trying to give Brent his time, which you can do in Berkeley. You can give someone else you only get a minute in Berkeley for many times up there. They actually have a shorter time, but you can give your time to other people. Here in Santa Cruz, that's not allowed, although, of course, the council majority could require that to be allowed, even if the mayor doesn't like it, even if Cynthia Matthews frowns upon it, even if Donna Myers doesn't like the idea. But, of course, that hasn't been proposed. And as you're going to hear from the conversation with Drew Glover coming up down the road here in the next segment of the show, it ain't likely to happen soon, because the most radical faction, unfortunately, seems to have been cowed and scared, and that's a real pity. I should say that if you want to support Drew Glover and Chris Crone in their fight against the recall that's coming up, there is a meeting 10:30 on Saturday, day after tomorrow, at the El Rio Mobile Home Park in the community room. And I understand it's open to the public. I may be going to it. I certainly support opposing the recall of Glover and Crone, however much I'm critical of and you're hearing my opinions on this show regarding Glover. I mean, yeah. So it's available for you if you want to go check that out. There's also a public public meeting of the Parks and Rec Commission at 4:00 coming up on Monday, and that's going to be in City Council chambers, I would imagine, and it's going to have a number of items on the agenda, including, I guess, the attempt to set in stone the bad decisions of the Loudoun-Nelson Community Center's closing of the bathrooms management decisions of last year, when those bathrooms are still closed unless you are a participant in one of their activities. So ordinary mortals who are in the community who need to take a leak or take a dump are just going to have to find somewhere else. There is a police station about a block away, and there is a private, apparently not very well-tended ultramat bathroom that is available at times. But the community center's bathroom, which should be open to the public and was open until it was unceremoniously closed as an anti-homeless measure more than a year ago, with no real justification, pretext about vandalism, pretext about needles and drug use. But Nothing more than the cost of doing business, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of the public records we found. Something that was supposed to be reexamined in January, but that Watkins, the mayor, shoveled into the background, and it hasn't been able to come back onto the city council agenda until August, and maybe not until September. It's not even clear that it's coming back then, so hold your water and take a dump in the bushes while you wait, I guess, is the answer. But there is this Parks and Rec meeting coming up on Monday at 4, if you want to. The issue will be coming to that commission, which advises the city council, although the city council will not be meeting for the next month. In fact, it doesn't meet until the second Tuesday in August. And then, as I'm assured, it has a very, very full agenda and cannot consider these more trivial issues of where you can empty your bladder if you're poor or if you're elderly or if you're a member of the community and you can't find a bathroom. And, well, that just seems to be the way it is at the moment.
Yeah, sure. I have a quick comment to Brent. I think we're going to stick with this, and if you want to talk with Brent afterwards, that's fantastic. I would want to send an email with your statements, so it'll go on the record as well.
I just want to say, yeah, this we got to keep working on this, you know, as much as we can. The police department's got to be more kind about how they deal with people that are sleeping outside. Try not to harass them if they can, you know, just try to do your best within what people are asking of you, what the council's asking of you. And we need to really, you know, move forward, like with Robert saying, on all these more and more alternatives. Not that we don't have any. There are alternatives. It's small, yeah, but... And this community and all communities have struggles with that. And even like in Utah, you know, when they got housing for everybody, but then a lot of the same problems started occurring again. So, you know, just housing is not the only part of this problem that we have, all these problems that we have. But certainly let's keep working on backyard, you know, units, granny units, mini housing, any, you know, campground type places, any way we can find other ways for people to live. Ask people who have large properties if they could set up, you know, like campgrounds on their property or safe places for people to park their vehicles, safe places that people come temporarily just to sleep outside in the tent, whatever. You know, it's just, we got to keep working on it, everyone. We can't just spin it around in circles. So let's just, everybody keep thinking and working.
Thank you. It can work. Advice from Lion, I love it. Thank you for your input, everybody.
Just two questions to respond to the public. One was the vehicle that goes, I wasn't sure what it was about, driving an hour to Aptos and back to pick up another vehicle.
That was for the first alarm.
Do you have any information about that?
And that was a question about the first alarm coverage, I think, of the east side. So here is another question from Chris Krohn, which is more on our topic. We're talking about police versus the homeless. So this is a question from Chris Krohn, I thought they'd going to zip past this, and apparently they went back to it, about what are the police instructed to do when they want to move someone along, but they ain't got nowhere to move them to.
Thanks. Other question is, where can I go? That's not my problem. You just have to go. What's the instructions for officers? And is it, you know, I know a lot of the shelters you have to be there by a certain time. If someone's found at, you know, 10 o'clock at night in a private doorway, what can they do, or what's the instructions?
So while I've been involved with some of the communication, I'm with the operations chief, talks about that mostly deals with the uniform staff.
Thank you. Okay.
We do have after-hours access to the River Street site, which I still believe has vacancies even today. I think we're at, 20 to 30?
River Street Camp,
correct.
Actually, there's two vacancies that are being filled.
Oh, glad to hear they're filled. And so there's still two vacancies?
And Martinez is making the false claim that someone could get into the River Street Camp on the basis of police bringing them in at night, without the original process of waiting until there's an actual vacancy, going through a selection process, getting through the waiting list. I seriously doubt this, and indeed I need to ask Eric Snigars about this. He's the ongoing director. It's something I'll bring back hopefully on Sunday, and I'll have more information on it then. But it's it seems highly unlikely to me. And it's not the way the Salvation Army usually proceeds. There's no indication that such beds are kept aside for that purpose. And even if they are, it's inappropriate to insist that somebody take a shelter bed. I don't know if I'm actually on solid ground here. I think the Martin versus Boise decision does say that if somebody refuses shelter, that you can then cite them under the even under the camping ordinance. But the actual claim that they're offering shelter, I have never heard of that happening recently in the last 3 or 4 years at all. They'll take you to a hospital, but they won't take you to a shelter. There's a shelter system. You have to be signed up for it, or you have to be present at one of the stops to go to it. It has to be within the appropriate hours. You have to be able to meet the barrier requirements. These things are all preconditions. So I think the officer is making misleading statements in order to reassure Crone that, this is all happening within the law and within the Boise constitutional decision, and everything is rosy. But I will hope to have more information on this on Sunday. And you will also hear staff member O'Hara, Susie O'Hara, chiming in with her usual chorus of misleading and false information. Not false in the most strict sense of its being untrue, but usually not being relevant to the question that really answers the question and gives a real solution in that situation, but appears to. And here it is.
That'll be a capacity.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're at capacity there. During the evening hours, we try to direct them to the warming shelters that are currently in operation.
And the warming center, of course, is not in operation at all during the summer and very relatively infrequently during the winter. That's the thing that Brent Adams runs, and it is a low-barrier shelter, which he runs essentially out of his pocket and the pocket of his supporters. He's not a wealthy man. He's a man who's organized a lot of people around this, to his credit.
So they'll go to Salvation Army, or we'll defer them to the waitlist at the River Street camp.
And the River Street camp is not available, as has been said repeatedly by Snickars to me in conversation. So Martinez is either ill-informed or deliberately misleading us. And you're going to hear O'Hara backing him up with claiming that there's other Salvation Army shelters. But those are shelters that were, at the time of this meeting, due to close at the end of July. Actually, I think it was at the end of June. But then again, we've learned they're going to stay open until, I believe it's the end of August, the 7th Avenue and the Laurel Street shelters, which is nice, but it doesn't really answer the question as to whether there actually is a procedure for people going to these shelters late at night. And I will hopefully find out about this soon, and I'll be able to give you more information around this. It would be a nice option for people to have for those who want to go to these shelters, or for those who would prefer that to being arrested, ticketed, fined, and harassed on the streets, because that's their only option. But we'll see if it actually exists.
At least now. But and then responding to Mr. Norris's comments, very general statements, no real specifics. If there is enforcement that appears out of bounds, I would strongly encourage any community member that feels that we are not on solid ground as it relates to any enforcement of homelessness to contact the shift supervisor and file a formal complaint. As of now, we haven't really received any complaints in relation to our enforcement.
I groaned when I heard this. The idea of the police department's investigating its own enforcement, though that's a useful notion, that we should be filing a whole series of complaints every time anybody is harassed. But more normally, homeless folks do not want to get into that sort of thing. Perhaps when the Union of the Homeless goes out to the River Street campground tomorrow, where there aren't going to be any complaints, probably because they have a place to go at night, although people get harassed during the day as well. It might be a useful suggestion, but normally people just, when the police leave them alone or say, get going, they don't want to troop on down to the police station the next day and get interviewed for a complaint, in large part because some such complaints almost invariably go nowhere. At least in the past, when there really was a police review board, when there was more pressure on this issue, 90-95% of complaints were either held unsustained, unfounded, or exonerated. It's just, it's not worth people's time to do it, even though they want to hold police accountable, even though they ultimately hope to have some kind of justice.
And, you know, what we're directing our staff to do is be very cautious around the Boise decision and obviously still protect people's property rights as well as their constitutional rights to sleep. And so that's what we're telling our staff. But drug use, open container violations, trespassing, blocking public access during public access hours is still on the books and still enforceable despite the Boise decision.
Yeah, absolutely. So just a quick...
I'm sorry, can I confirm just one thing with regard to the shelter bed capacity?
Is this a real answer? Is it true? I'll have to find out if people are actually being sent to shelters. I haven't heard of anything like this happening in the last 6 months. And even if it is, the court's decision is you don't, if you're in a city where there's inadequate shelter, you, maybe the police are doing this. You don't cite people regardless of if there is, they have a bed or two they're keeping open as they used to do 20 years ago in Miami when there was a similar decision protecting sort of homeless people in that area that said you don't approach people at all unless you have a bed available for them. The police would direct the shelters to keep a couple beds open, and so they could always say, we're going to arrest you unless you move along, asshole, sir, if you will. So they did move on because they have a bed they could then claim, oh, well, you see, we've got a bed for you. But the bed is not something that a person who has a lot of property with them and is going to lose their property if they get taken to the shelter or the bed, and then have to leave at 5 in the morning the next morning, is going to want to do. And therefore, what it really is it's a way of giving the police the tools to get homeless people to do whatever they're directed to do, regardless of what the courts have said. And now we have Susie O'Hara chiming in.
And so that's what we're calling our staff. But drug use, open container violations, trespassing, blocking public access during public access hours, is still on the books and still enforceable despite the Boise decision.
Yeah, absolutely. So just a quick...
I'm sorry, can I confirm just one thing with regard to the shelter bed capacity? So there are currently 40 beds available at the VFW and Lowell Street, and we are really actively working to outreach more folks to get people into those two shelters and kind of revamping our shuttle service for those two programs. There is walk-in available shuttle at Coral and Limekiln every day, 7 days a week at 6:15 p.m. So we're really trying to get as many people to utilize those beds as we possibly can. But we have a lot of vacancies right now.
And if they have some vacancies, that does not go to the issue of what you do when you find someone at 8 or 9 o'clock at night, as there are many people outside and you want to get rid of them in a certain area. Then are you going to then, do they really have access to shelter at that time? And the answer is no, they don't. And that's something Susie O'Hara is concealing with these comments. That's why it's a misleading comment. That's why I tend to really feel a kind of real resentment at her pretensions to being a social service provider when she gives answers that are misleading in this way. The notion that somehow people have real options after, you know, at night when the police approach them outside, or even during the day when there are so many people and ultimately so few shelter beds, and such a high access bar to those beds.
And they'll also take after hours referrals from us directly, and we'll do courtesy transport for those all hours, 24/7.
Any other questions?
And that courtesy transport at all hours. I'd like to see some records on that. And I think I may have even put in a Public Records Act request on that issue. But perhaps not. Perhaps I still need to do that. So many things to do and so little time, energy, and sometimes motivation.
So if some, if there, if you're speaking to someone at, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning, et cetera, and so they did want to go into a shelter, you would do a transport?
Correct. Correct. We transport their property, their service animal, whatever. We'll get them into a safer, better place if we can accommodate it and we can make it happen. And of course, there's capacity. Obviously, we all know we're all striving for increased capacity, so we can get people off the streets and into a better, safer place. And we're trying to do our best in order to facilitate that, since we're the ones out there making those initial interventions almost daily. So.
And for years, we have asked the Homeless Lack of Services Centers, Paige Smith and Paul Lee and River Street Shelter, when they had shelter, to have an association with the police where a police officer could do exactly what Martinez is saying they claim to do now, but I've never heard any examples of this being done, which is to say, contact the shelter, say, do you have a bed for them? If you don't, then we'll leave you alone. If we do, then we'll offer to take you there. This is, in essence, what he's saying now, which sounds like it might actually meet the Boise Martin requirements. If they're doing it, you would say, would a police officer baldly lie about this kind of thing? I'm just incredulous because I've never heard of it happening before. Now, I could be wrong. So we'll see what the data show. Or if the data don't show this and they want to change their policies and magically suddenly create shelter space and or lower barriers and or actually provide real police transport for folks, then we should insist that hundreds of people demand shelter in these places and see what the actual response is. I suppose that's another strategy we might try. I mean, I'll propose it to the Union of the Homeless and see what they suggest. Though many of these shelter spaces are not the healthiest places to be, again, you can't take your property with you except for a small amount. And while it's very nice that Brent Adams provides storage for folks of a kind, it only covers a small portion of the, a much larger portion, by the way, than other services. But he's limited. He claims to have unlimited capacity, which means he is in genuinely trying to expand based upon, and he showed me his services, his storage area, as much as he can. But people can't. It's hard to explain the situation of a homeless person to someone who's housed. But if you carry your entire life with you, what you usually do is you hide it somewhere during the day and you come back to it at night when you go to sleep, whether it's in the poganip or hidden in a bush somewhere or in some distant green belt area, other green belt area. You can't carry it with you. And you can't also stash it in storage because you need to have access to it as well. During the night when you're, and when you wake up in the morning, if you need the kind of things we normally do in our homes. So it's just not possible to realistically suggest that police officers can pick people up and all their stuff and dump it in a location as a real alternative at night. And also, these services are not open at night for this kind of thing. So that's why it's unlikely that what the officer is saying is accurate.
You build the capacity, you show us where the door is. I've said this many times. We will get them through the door. Just tell us where it is.
Thank you, Deputy Police Chief. So we are at 6:56 right now. Ms. Cool, as a representative of the Santa Cruz Homeless Union, and you seems like you wish to respond to this.
I'll just be really quick. I just had a question involving those interventions. How many people have been transported to a shelter, like in the middle of the night, if that's actually ever happened? And also, I wanted to point out that I've personally witnessed, he mentioned the constitutional right to sleep. I've personally witnessed people being woken up and given trespass tickets and or being told to move along. And I would also like to speak on the shelter availability, the reason why you're seeing a high vacancy rate in those particular shelters is that they are extremely high barrier. They are somewhat difficult. You can only have one bag of belongings to get into them. They are restricted in hours, and they are also only overnight. So there are some reasons why those ones remain vacant. Just things to consider. Thank you.
Anything that you want to procure or submit to us to review to solidify your claims, that would be fantastic. Just any kind of...
I can email you. I don't have anything with me right now, but I can email you
totally.
As to the fact regarding that.
We want to appreciate the work that the police department does. We also want to be open and transparent with any concerns that you have as a community.
Certainly. Well, and on my page, Santa Cruz County Homeless Advocates, there are multiple... videos and photos showing that happening to people. So that's open page that anyone can look at.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
The police for their stance.
So that will then close.
I guess not.
Unless there's any questions specifically, I think one thing that was brought up was do we have data of how many people were actually transferred to shelters after being engaged on the street or given citations?
This should be good.
The shelter should probably have that data because they're taking those late night referrals, but we're not actively tracking that. We might be able to do a CAD search based on courtesy transport numbers. That's something we could delve into further for sure.
I know that I think it would probably be good just to be able to provide that content to the community so they know the kind of work they were doing as an added data set to be.
And the conversation, of course, has been switched from just the simple question, one instance where anybody has been actually taken to a shelter yourself in the last month, 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, to, we don't have any data set, though. We could research that and find out what the situation is. In other words, it all sounds very professional, but in terms of any common sense experience, we aren't hearing anything.
Able to start tracking and keeping track of who transfers and where, or if that's too much for the staff who we already know about what's going on, if you could figure out a way that we could help make that a reality, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, we could delve into that, and we certainly should be tracking it. Brett and I were just talking about an example of actually utilizing him to transport large amounts of property since he had the van. And so we've actually utilized his services in the past to assist with the courtesy transport.
And what Martinez is talking about here is Brent's van to help transport. And I'm assuming he's talking about, Brent, when the Ross Camp was closed and some people wanted to move their stuff out of Ross Camp to 1220 River when there was some space for 60 people out of the hundreds who were at Ross Camp and being driven away and their property being bulldozed and destroyed the next few days. That indeed they did help because the city's objective was to destroy Ross Camp, and part of the deal would be move people out and move their property out, at least during that very limited period of time. But it has nothing to do with finding someone on the street and who is looking for shelter or who the police want to get out of there, and so they're offering him shelter and then taking them to a sheltered place along with their property. Again, as I said, I've never heard of that happening recently, certainly. So I'd be interesting to see if any data comes out, but I don't think. Well, we'll see. I don't think it's happening, and I'll be surprised if we find it did.
So I'll just let you know what the collaboration level actually looks like.
Okay, so now we're going to transition over into item number 5. This is local social media discourse concerning hate crimes. So this is a rather serious one. Is there someone that would like, I believe there was the president of the Santa Cruz Homeless Union that would like to give a short presentation on that. How long do you think you'll need?
Just a few minutes.
Maybe 5 minutes.
Okay. I probably won't even take that long. As you know, I submitted a presentation at the last city council meeting, perhaps the one prior, and it showed several posts on a group, Facebook group called Santa Cruz Looks Like Shit, And on that Facebook group, there have been multiple postings of people basically tracking unhoused people who are vehicle dwellers, and they will go on there and post like where they're parked. And subsequently in the comments, several different people in our community have said things like, get the baseball bats, let's get matches, let's light them on fire, torch it. Just recently today, I came across one of our city workers that does the streets cleaning. I believe Mike Lillier, I might be pronouncing that wrong, had a whole bunch of terrible things to say about the homeless. He announces when he's sweeping Coral Street. Somebody went on there and said that their dog can be an escort to him, that their dog likes raw meat. So I'm just highly concerned with the threats of vigilantism towards the homeless community. People are scared, and so I just wanted to request that some investigation be done in regards to that. I know that our police chief, for whatever reason, is a member of the group Santa Cruz Looks Like Shit, so I believe he's aware of these things. I would like to see something done about this to protect all members of our community equally. Thank you.
Absolutely, thank you.
Public comment?
Is there anyone from the police department that would like to talk about the situation at hand? It was brought forward at the last city, or not at the last city council meeting, but at a previous city council meeting. Is there any forward motion on that, or what's happening with regards to the hate speech or the calls for vigilante violence online?
Well, unfortunately, even on the, as reprehensible as the comments are, there's no crime. There's no penal code section crime. There are only, harassment is not a crime. There's a civil code crime that is not, that is a civil violation of harassment, or a hate crime that has a specific action that is taken. The only crime that falls under whether or not a terrorist threat or a death threat, it has to have a threat, means, and immediacy. It all has to have all those combined. And it's a very specific intent crime that has a very, has the ability for the crime to actually be carried out in a very specific and immediate manner. While these are extremely disturbing, and the language could be, it's like any social media. There's all kinds of people ranting and raving and saying completely despicable, inappropriate, racist, you name it. Unfortunately, the overwhelming majority of that is a constitutionally protected right of free speech. Even if so, even some of the comments that were just presented, as far as somebody tracking somebody and stuff like that, I don't know if there's a civil law violation of that, and that would be more of something that would happen in a civil court. But as far as a criminal violation of, you know, there is no criminal violation of harassment or pointing somebody's out or their behavior. Saying even something about them, they mention of, as bad as it is, as, you know, let's get baseball bats or my dog likes meat. There's no immediacy. There's no intent to show that this is actually going to be carried out. Now, that being said, we do take social media posts when they come down and they meet that, or somebody from the public has presented, hey, here's this page, here's this post, and it's very specific and it's directed at an individual, and we think this individual has means. Then there is a whole threat assessment that protocol that we would then follow, following under the legal guidelines of what we could investigate, looking at, you know, potentially the person's access to firearms, interviewing family or friends of this individual, finding out what life stressors they have, finding out what other comments they may have made offline that show in a specific that they are intending to carry out this act. I mean, the Constitution works both ways, unfortunately. I mean, it is there to protect the speech, but then sometimes when we don't like the speech or what is out there on social media, that is also protected.
So, I've often thought that assault has to do with threatening another person, putting them in fear of some kind of jeopardy. But if you look online, this is what I get when I go to a dictionary definition, a legal dictionary definition. A common law, an intentional act by one person that creates an apprehension in another of an imminent harmful or offensive contact. An assault is carried out by a threat of bodily harm coupled with an apparent present ability to cause that harm. It is both a crime and a tort, that is, a civil crime, too, and therefore may result in either criminal or civil liability. Statutory definitions of assault in the various jurisdictions throughout the United States are not substantially different from the common law definition. Generally, the essential elements of an assault consist of an act intended to cause an apprehension of harmful or offensive contact that causes apprehension of such contact in the victim. The act required for an assault must be overt. Although words alone are insufficient, they might create an assault when coupled with some action that indicates the ability to carry out the threat. A mere threat to harm is not an assault. However, a threat combined with a raised fist might be sufficient if it causes a reasonable apprehension of harm in the victim. Intent is an essential element of assault. In tort law, it can be a specific intent if the assailant intends to cause the apprehension of harmful, offensive contact in the victim, or general intent if he or she intends to do the act that causes such apprehension. Not sure what the difference is. In addition, the intent element is satisfied if it is substantially certain to a reasonable person that the act will cause the result. A defendant who holds a gun to a victim's head possesses the requisite intent, since it is substantially certain that this act will produce an apprehension in the victim. In all cases, intent to kill or harm is irrelevant. In criminal law, the attempted battery type of assault requires a specific intent, and we won't get into that. In other words, what I'm saying here is that while you may not, may be hard to find a definition of harassment, the notion, the common sense notion and common law notion of an assault, which is something that produces apprehension of bodily harm and seems reasonably like it could happen, that's a form of assault even if you don't touch the person. And so, I'm not as concerned as Alicia Kuhl is with these kinds of comments online, at least in terms of defending against them through suppressing them with censorship. I'm not a fan of the hate speech suppression, even though I understand why a lot of people are, because I think it's when you put that kind of power in government agencies' hands, they are more likely to go after, you know, we hate our landlord. Oh, that's hate speech. Go get him, you know. Because, oh, we hate those rich people. Oh, we hate that rich bank. Oh, hate speech. Okay, you can't talk about that. Oh, you know, a combination of labor against the employer. Oh, that's not good. We don't want those unions doing that. That's the kind of stuff that has traditionally been a problem. And so I have a lot of perhaps undue respect for the First Amendment in this regard. Running out of time here, I intended to play this long conversation, fairly long conversation I had with Drew Glover earlier today. I'm going to have to postpone it until Sunday. I will remind you that there is a meeting of the resistance to the recall coming up at 10:30 at the trailer park, the Orio trailer park in the community room at 10:30 on Saturday. There's also later that day at from 4 to 6 a demonstration against the war in Iran, which I think is a very serious situation. I probably should be devoting a lot more time to it, and I'm not. So, my bad. In more ways than one, just not just the words. And then there's also this meeting coming up on Monday at the police, the Parks and Rec Commission, which does a lot of policing, so that's understandable that I would say policing. I'm going to play a little bit more of this discussion of the hate speech concern of Facebook comments that Alicia Kuhl is very concerned about at the Public Safety Committee. And then we're going to bow out, and I'll get back to you on Sunday, presumably, if you get back to me.
So my advice would be is if there is a very specific threat, meaning like I mean, because me even saying, me being a public figure, I would never say this, but me saying to somebody, hey, I'm going to kill you, but I don't have the means, I'm not dressed like, you know, I'm just ranting like I'm going to kill you, that in itself is not a crime as well. It has to have. I had the intent. I had that. We that is the burden of the proof that
so
we have to
wait for it to happen.
So that's the collection. If they're, again, if somebody has a very specific body-specific post, then that needs to be brought forward, and then that whole threat assessment. I mean, there's media posts about everything out there.
You know, it's interesting, however, if a housed person complains that some homeless person has ranted at them, the police may be there very quickly and drive the homeless person away or charge them. But suddenly it becomes a very complicated issue if it's a matter of a housed vigilante group urging people to get together and harass homeless people in RVs, or even give specific descriptions of RVs, which is what's happening on Facebook pages, and saying, you know, hey, try some matches and so forth, and doing so under their names, mind you, the names of the insiders, the perpetrators are actually, they don't mind speaking about this. They feel privileged. They feel like they have a right to speak. And the real issue also has to do with whether these are government officials. That is to say, whether they're in a position of power and doing this as well. I'm particularly concerned with people like Joe Habe, runs around banging on vans in the wee hours of the morning, and gets a medal from Chief Mills for doing so. I'm concerned when an officer goes around the Limekiln, Fern, and Coral Street area actively soliciting businesses to create no parking zones that will particularly discriminate against homeless people. That is the politicizing the whole situation in a way that is, well, definitely a politics I don't like and find destructive of basic human rights, and also a kind of bullying that sickens me and actually frightens me as well. I don't really feel fearful. I guess I feel more angry than fearful when this is happening. Anyway, a little of this, and then we go away because we don't have much time left. Let's see what we got here.
They're even in Santa Cruz. And so do we as a police department routinely skim through all social media to find it? No, we don't. We don't have the time and resource, nor do we just randomly go out and pry on the public's what they're posting.
Or do you, but more importantly, when someone calls in and says, someone's threatening my RV, and you see all these posts on Facebook, do the police say, oh, that's First Amendment protected, you know, sorry, can't help you, next call?
But if there is that specific, very disturbing, that seems like, hey, this person's reaching a threat level that we think they are going to carry out this act, then that's when we would investigate, is this free speech or is it leaning on to more of the criminal side?
But the real question is the climate of hostility that is being created. That's the real problem. The climate of hatred, the tolerance and the new norm of people being dehumanized who are poor and homeless.
If it's just speech that's not liked, or it even causes a little bit of fear, that still doesn't necessarily make it reach the criminal offense that we can take any action on, or that the district attorney's office or the courts bar.
However, we've heard, at least reading from the definition of assault, creating a fear of harm, if the harm, it doesn't have to be imminent, but if it seems like it's reasonable and can happen, that's assault. So I'm not quite sure if our police department isn't, in this very particular case, saying something like, there's a reason we don't go after these bigots because blah, 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 blah. Rather, it's not, in other words, they're not making general arguments in a neutral, even-handed way, but responding to a particular criticism that they don't want to respond to.
Bring a civil injunction for defamation or something like that.
Right. Okay, great. So this is great, I think, information for the community in general, so mm-hmm. they know where your line is, what they can expect with response from the police department, as well as what's in line. Something that comes up for me is, if something were to happen that were in line with the statements that someone made on a post, without being specific about an individual, but say they call for the use of baseball bats on someone experiencing homelessness, and then someone shows up with baseball bat wounds that's experiencing homelessness, what does that look like for the person making those statements?
again, we would have to, I mean, yeah, that is if you have a specific crime that occurred, which you're describing, somebody was beaten with baseball bats, would be a felony crime. We would investigate that and look towards the potential leads. I would hope that we would be able to skim through social media and find a pointer, or that there would be, in response to this violent crime, and that there would be additional posts that would, you know, people would be, the talk would be out. Hey, did you see this person?
And unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it here. But again, I find myself being swarmed with rhetoric. It reminds me a little bit of Susie O'Hara for some reason. I don't know why. I guess these... maybe I'm just terminally prejudiced. Anyway, here's a little musical exit from this particular edition of Bathroom Spears Broadsides. Carol Denny, "The Rich Will Never Be Poor."
As certain as the sun will rise and politicians have lying eyes, as sure as suffering multiplies, the rich will never be poor. As certain as in life you learn, the rich have money and time to burn, the rich will counsel you, wait your turn, in heaven you'll get some more. As sure as poverty plagues the land, the rich will give you a helping hand, as soon as mountains return to sand and oceans leave the shore. Count on nothing in life so well, that if the rich go straight to hell, lots are something they buy and sell, they'll never enter the door. Clearly all that you need in life to be at peace in a world of strife, the company of a man or wife and lots of money in store. Life is simple and so complete, with faithful friends and some bread to eat, a solid roof and a room with heat and stocks and bonds galore. The rich will probably tell you needs and riches that really pay. The rich have always got lots to say as they watch their assets soar. Count on nothing in life so plain, the poor have water, the rich champagne. The market rises to this refrain: the rich will never be poor, the rich will never be poor. Sure as life is a strange affair, in need of some robust repair, the rich don't actually have to care, the rich will never be poor. Maybe people are all the same, but the rich are playing a different game. You take your chances and take your aim, you'll never even the score. The rich can't help it if life's unfair, the richer people, they really care. They often mention it's hard to bear, they're burdened at their core. Some say no, but it's plain to see, the rich are different than you and me. The rich are different as they can be. The rich will never be poor. The rich will never be poor. The rich will never be poor. The rich will never be poor.
Duck. Dear listeners, all of us here at Free Radio Santa Cruz announce with great sadness that our dear and beloved Uncle Dennis has passed away, surrounded by the love of his family. You may remember him for his truly great show, From the Cream to the Dregs, or for the so much needed echo news about the state of our planet, like Earth First Update. Uncle Dennis was one of the founders of Free Radio Santa Cruz. He dedicated much of his life to its survival, keeping the ship going despite all the difficulties, from the recovery after the 2004 raid and the consequent confiscation of gear, to the frequent site change for transmitter and antenna. We largely owe to Uncle Dennis the nearly uninterrupted broadcast for these couple decades. We all will remember him as a true guide for our collective and a wonderful, generous companion of many adventures. He made many years of Free Radio Santa Cruz possible, and we are so grateful for his dedication and so saddened by his passing. Rest in peace, dear Uncle Dennis, great show host, friend, leader, one amazing pirate of the air.
People who we've never really heard of.
Screw this, it's our birthday party. Woo-hoo. Happy birthday to Radio. Happy birthday to Free Radio. Happy birthday, dear Free Radio. Happy birthday to us.
You confuse me.
Well, Robert, you've...
Your stentorian voice.
You've been here since the beginning.
Not quite. You were there before I was there, I think.
Well...
Like a month
ago. You were there before the beginning.
I was there before the beginning, but I wasn't in the studio before. There wasn't a studio before the beginning, actually.
Well, there was a meeting at Loudon Nelson Center.
I probably was
all there. That many years ago.
I think I was probably there.
And I was there. Stephen Dunifer was there.
I was with Stephen Dunifer 2 years before on the streets of Berkeley in front of KPFA broadcasting me.
Well, I didn't really mean to start a pissing contest here. I just want to point out that Free Radio has been around a while.
Yes, we have indeed. So this is a live broadcast party today.
Well, so far.
Cool.
And we invite our listeners to call in with their reminiscences of Free Radio past.
I'll buy that. I mean, I thought this was supposed to be an official meeting for new members, one of those secret meetings I've heard so much about.
Well, if there's any business to process, I suppose we can process business, but as far as I'm concerned, processing beer is the agenda item of the day.
That makes sense. And you're
you want to sort CDs or something, Robert?
I'm just going to observe. I don't want to be interfere with your beer drinking activities.
Well, we need CD sorting. They haven't been sorted in a while.
They are very sorted, as far as I can see. Extremely sorted.
With a T. Sorted.
Oh, sorted. Now I understand. Good point. Here's the policies and guidelines.
You want to read the policies and guidelines?
It's 10 pages. I don't think our listeners would be that interested in our policies and guidelines.
Well, I guess this is a chance for our listeners to call in and say what they are interested in.
Yeah, what are you interested in? Come on. Give us a call, 427-3772.
You guys have been here for a while. What was the very first thing broadcast?
I have no idea.
What? Well, I don't think either of us were there for the very first broadcast. Probably... Mark Bob, Phil Free, perhaps? Ed Fry?
Does Bob have a program again? Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, he's always had a program. He's not going to be coming into the studio.
We could call Vincent Lombardo and ask him to.
I don't know if Vinny's in town.
I don't think he is, but I have no idea, actually. What about George and Jim?
They're in town.
Really?
George is probably studying. She's supposed to be writing her senior paper.
She's not that old.